You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
It is an absolute delight to introduce the compere, the interviewer, the lead for your next session. You're going to be hearing from Michael Sheen. You're going to be hearing from Martin Joseph. But it is a delight to invite to the stage now an absolute lifelong, passionate Greenbelter and podcast commissioner. It's Rhianne Roberts.
Hello, everybody. It's really nice to see you. Lots of people come from the communion service. How beautiful was that? What a joy to be in the field together. And who would have thought that if you were in your tent last night thinking, I don't think this is ever going to end. I'm going to be in a little rivulet just further down the field. Anyway, I don't want to hold us back from spending time with our two guests, Michael Sheen. I'm hoping he's going to appear up there. Otherwise, you've got me for an hour, which is not going to be very exciting. And also, Martin Joseph will be with us too, who's got a special song that's related to some of Michael's work. And some of you might have guessed what that is already. But I just want to say, Michael Sheen, croeso.
Hello.
And Michael can see all of you, or maybe not all of you individually, but he can definitely feel the vibe, so give him a big wave.
I can see you right there.
And I'm going to say, Michael, croeso cynnes iawn i'r pabell yma. Well, dyma pabell, dipyn bach o pabell. Oes na bobl yma sydd yn siarad Cymraeg? Yes! Hello, my Welsh friends. Now, Michael doesn't speak much Welsh, so I'm going to have to stop that as well. But I always like to get a little word in at the top. And for people who know me, you will hear me code switch absolutely 100% to my Welsh accent. So this is fantastic for me. Michael, it's lovely to have you here. And I've been looking at your work, and it took me quite a while because you have done so many brilliant and beautiful things. And some of the things you've been doing recently, they really seem to come from your home, your place, where you belong, your projects. So I wanted to ask you about, where do you consider home? The place where your soul goes, ah.
Well, I suppose, I mean, geographically, in terms of home, it's obviously Wales. And specifically, I suppose, Port Talbot, which is where I grew up and where my family all have lived. And having moved back there, which I never thought, I certainly wasn't anticipating that or planning it, but I did move back there after living in Los Angeles for about 15 years, where my older daughter grew up there. And when she got to the age of 18 and left home and went off to New York, I realized, oh, I can go home now. And in the time that I had spent in America, I thoroughly enjoyed it. There. It was lovely. There was lots of great things. But I always felt like a part of me was missing, you know. That. So when you talk about a sense of belonging, I suppose it's more to do with your tribe, I think, isn't it? I think that's what I realized. Or even more than the sense of place, it's being with your tribe, your community, where you feel supported and known and seen and heard, and that when you need help, it's there. And when others need help, you're there. And I think that's where you feel a real sense of belonging. Because, of course, I mean, I'm sure many, many people have been in what they would call home, and it doesn't feel like a safe place, or it doesn't have that sense of, same sense of belonging. So I think it's more to do with being with your tribe, your community. And maybe even beyond that, and I think I was just looking at the Green Belt Festival manifesto and the things that was written about it, that's written about it. And it made me think that sort of even deeper than that, even deeper than your community and your tribe, in order to really make the most of wherever you are, you have to be there. You have to be present. You have to be in the moment, as we call it, as actors, to feel as much as we possibly can as human beings, given that we have all kinds of restrictions on us and filters and prisms to see things in. If we can let all that go and be where we are and be with who we're with, then I think you can find that sense of belonging anywhere, maybe, and to really feel like you're at home. If you aren't in that place, then it becomes difficult to feel like you belong anywhere. And if I may, Rian, in reading that manifesto, I came across this phrase. Now, many people will probably be aware of this already, but it really stood out for me. It says, "Here's to every green belter who makes the pilgrimage each year," and I'm sure there's many of you who are pilgrims in that way, "because a part of them always belongs in the bright field." Now, that really jumped out to me because as a big fan of R.S. Thomas's poetry, for those of you who know R.S. Thomas's poetry, he wrote a poem called The Bright Field, which speaks directly to this. Gosh, it's almost like we worked this out, didn't it? May I read to you the poem The Bright Field by R.S. Thomas?
I can't tell you how much we would love that. This is kind of great. A dream come true for all of us, I think. Oh, we've got Michael Sheen. And a little bit of R.S. Over to you.
It will speak to what I was just talking about much better than I can. This is The Bright Field by R.S. Thomas. I have seen the sun break through to illuminate a youth once that is the eternity that awaits you. What about that? How do you like them apples? It's not bad, is it?
Have you got the whole book there, Michael? Because, I mean, I don't really have any more questions.
No, it was that poem jumped out at me. And, in fact, I can't remember now if I did. Myself and Martin Joseph, who you've already heard from, I'm sure, and you're going to hear from soon again. Yep. But we last year we did sort of an experiment, really, where I did some poetry and he did some songs. And we didn't really work out beforehand what was going to happen. And we did it as part of the Swansea Culture Festival, the cultural weekend. And I decided in a very kind of ramshackle way I'll do poems by Dylan Thomas and R.S. Thomas. I thought, you know, they both got the same surname. That seems like a theme. And Martin said, well, I'll just listen to the poems and then I'll choose from my extensive library of what songs I can do every now and again. So when people got bored of my voice, then Martin took over. But it was an amazing evening. It was fantastic. I absolutely loved it. And I hope Martin did as well. And I'm not sure if I read that poem. I think I did. I think I'm pretty sure I did that poem. But to compare R.S. Thomas and Dylan Thomas, who were very different people, very different personalities, but also very different poets in their style, but touched on similar subject matter. And there's a sort of celebration of the present in both of their work, but coming at it from different ways. And I suppose that's what sort of jumped out at me when we start to talk about a sense of belonging and a sense of place.
I think
that there are many different types of it, aren't there? There are many different types of belonging.
Sorry to jump in. You can hear there's a bit of a lag, so forgive us. We're not deeply rude people. We're just trying to work with what we've got in front of us. I'm going to write to those Greenbelt trustees and say, I think we just need that session in the next bright field we are in.
Wonderful.
And I'm going to try and persuade Michael Sheen and Martin Joseph to learn a little bit more Welsh as well. They've got two years. I can do private lessons if you like, honestly. That'd be a personal joy. Anyway, I better ask a question. So one of the things I've watched that you have done recently, and other people may have watched it too, is the Buried documentary. It's on BBC iPlayer now if you want to watch it. And it's a tremendous piece of work where you're in a different role, really, because this is a serious investigative, your own self playing no role, going back to find out what happened in your community in Newport and also in Rabon in North Wales, which was part of where my family also lived as well at that time. And there was do you want to explain a bit about it? It'd be better if you do than I do. What's the premise of the documentary, Michael?
Yeah, sure. Well, it all started for me about 10 years ago, really, where when I was living in America, and a teacher from the Rhondda had written me a letter about a project she was doing with her school children. And I was just about to write back to her. And I just thought, I just want to look up what Rhondda Cynon Taf means. So I went on the Wikipedia page for Rhondda Cynon Taf and was reading through it. And then I came across this one little entry, tiny, just one line, that was called something like environmental controversy or something like that. And it just said, Brofiskin Quarry was named one of the most contaminated places in Britain. And that's all it said. And that, so I went down, you know, one of those rabbit holes that you can go down. And came across the story of a man called Douglas Gowan. And Douglas Gowan, in the sort of mid to late 60s, was working for the National Union of Farmers. And as a young man, and they got a call by a farmer near Llantrisant, just outside Cardiff, who was very concerned about what was happening on his farm to animals, livestock, sort of crayfish in the streams and the rivers and stuff. He was finding very strange things, and was worried and wanted someone to come down. So Douglas Gowan went down there, and ultimately discovered that there was a quarry next to the farm, Brofiskin Quarry, and that it was being used as a dump site for toxic waste from the nearby Monsanto factory. And it turns out that this Monsanto factory was producing a third of the world's what are called PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, which was a man-made compound that was put into in all kinds of things. But it was in as a sort of flame retardant, as a cooler, so to stop things like paint going on fire or electrical things. So it was used a lot. And they were making these PCBs, but the problem with the PCBs were that they don't break down very easily. They're known as the first of the forever chemicals. And this stuff was being dumped in this quarry, and there was sort of no rules or regulation around it at the time. So Douglas Gowan discovered this and was convinced, and did some testing, was convinced that it was leakage from the quarry, from this toxic barrels. They were shoved in there in barrels that was leaking into the farm and was affecting the livestock. And this began essentially a lifetime for Douglas of investigating this stuff, trying to get Monsanto to be accountable for it, to try and get something done about it. And so as I read this anyway, as I was sitting there in my kitchen in Los Angeles, I realized two things. One, this was an extraordinary story. And if Douglas was right, he was saying that there were these dump sites were all over the place, all over Wales, but in other places as well. And that they were a present danger and a future danger. This wasn't something historical. This was something that was dangerous potentially now and for future generations. And so I was shocked by that for a start. And then also shocked by how little there was about it. I could find nothing about it. There was one article essentially in the Ecologist magazine. Anyway, cut long story short, I thought, I wonder if he's still alive, if he's still around, this man Douglas Gowan. I wonder if I can get in touch with him. And I did. I managed to track him down, and he lived in Norfolk. And I said, could I come and speak to you and hear your story? And he said, yes, please do come, and come soon, because I'll be dead soon. And I sort of thought he was joking. So I went down to Norfolk. A friend of mine who had his own camera came with me, and we filmed Douglas for 2 days. I had about 7 or 8 hours of footage of him telling me his story. And he told me the full story of everything, which included his investigations, his trying to get accountability, him being beaten up by men with iron bars, his phone being tapped, his house being burgled, his name being rubbished in the court. He had to go into witness protection at one point. I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and he was an extraordinary storyteller. And after I had all this stuff, within 6 months he was dead, and so he wasn't joking. It was true. He believed that he had been poisoned by these PCBs. There were such high levels of it in his body because of his work over the years that this had shut his immune system down essentially and kind of killed him. So I had this story, I had this footage, and I was sort of drawn to it both as a you know, investigative piece, as a warning, as something that needed something being done about it now, but also like an amazing story, a drama, like it possibly a really compelling drama. And on the investigative side, I thought, well, I can't do this. I don't know. You know, I need someone to take this on, really. And so within a short space of time, I was asked to do something called the Raymond Williams Lecture. And in that, I mentioned the story of Douglas Gowan as a way to kind of try and send it out there and see if someone would pick up on it. And nothing came of it until years later, like 6-7 years later or something, I had a call from my agent saying there are these people called Dan Ashby and Lucy, Dan and Lucy, who are environmental investigative journalists, and they want to talk to you about Douglas Gowan. Okay. So I spoke to them on the phone, and they had made a podcast series, a very successful award-winning podcast series called Buried. And the first series had been about the kind of waste disposal racket in Northern Ireland. It was essentially a sort of mafia, organized criminal sort of campaign there. And they said the second series they wanted to do as this podcast series, they wanted to do about Douglas Gowan. And they had come across in their research this Raymond Williams lecture that I had done. I'd mentioned it, so they got in touch to see if I'd be interested in being a part of it. And I said, well, funnily enough, I have 8 hours of Douglas telling his story. And so we decided we would team up. And we did the podcast series, and that went very well and had a big impact. And then we decided that we would try and make it as a documentary as well. So we ended up making this two-part documentary where we take it even further than where we went with the podcast series and go to the sites that Douglas had talked about. I went over to Anniston in Alabama, which is where a similar thing had happened, where the Monsanto had been toxic dumping there, and it had decimated this community. And they had taken them to court, and they had got a settlement. They still hadn't been able to get official responsibility taken, but there was a huge settlement made, and so it was seen as a great victory. And so I went over there to talk to them and to the lawyers and to the community, and tried to meet up with as many people around Wales as possible who were there were councillors, independent councillors called the Two Jans, in Cardiganshire, and they had been fighting against what they saw was happening in their area, where there was again a dump site and a quarry on the top of a hill, and they were worried that there was danger with that. So we met all these people, Reverend Paul Cawthorn, who's been working on this for years and years. All these sort of very unlikely, this unlikely Avengers team got assembled. And the episode so far had a huge, I mean, overwhelming response. And the point of making them really was to try and get something done about it. We do a tiny amount of testing. I had my own blood tested for the PCB levels in it. It's really shocking what we found, and people are shocked by it, and people have been really galvanized, and we've received so many messages from people who are giving us more information or telling us about their experiences of what's going on in their communities. So I'm going to speak at the House of Commons in a couple of weeks with the Welsh Affairs Committee there. And I'm hoping that we can, you know, really push to get something done on this. But the problem has been, of course, that the local councils are so terrified in these areas where there is, we believe, contaminated land and where toxic dumping has happened. The councils are so terrified that they'll be held financially responsible because it'll bankrupt them. They simply wouldn't be able to afford to do it. That it's very difficult to know whether the appropriate amount of testing and remediation and safeguards have been put in place, because once you declare the land as contaminated, certain legal things kick in and they do become responsible. And whilst we're in this sort of this Mexican standoff in a way, where we're saying something needs to be done, there's clearly something dangerous here and the communities are up in arms about it, and the council's like, well, we've done a bit of testing and we don't think it is. But, you know, it's hard to know whether they're just saying that because they're so terrified of being made bankrupt by any financial responsibility. Then nothing's going to happen. So we have to find a way beyond that. And so I'm hoping that the response to the documentaries will help that. And for anyone here who hasn't seen it, please do watch them and get on board with this push to get something done.
And please do watch it. I mean, it's a devastating piece of journalism. And and we know that Greenbelters do take action. We're an active lot. So you watch it, and if there's something that you feel you could contribute, then I really do urge you to do it. There's a moment in it, Michael, where you are sitting with the people whose land has been poisoned, and there's a heartbreak in the room, and there's a list of all the different people who have contracted these really rare cancers. And I don't know whether I was reading too much into it, but to poison the place that you call home. And then to hear there's no coming back, because those are forever chemicals in the land. That you'll be alongside those people now, I guess, as they go through this with you.
Absolutely. I mean, a part of what just made me so angry and so galvanized and catalyzed to do as much as I possibly can was the knowledge that, I mean, essentially the Monsanto factory in Alabama was forced to shut down production of these things, these PCBs, because of what it was doing to the community. They knew full well how dangerous this stuff was and how much it could affect people. And when they had to shut it down, they decided we found a memo, an internal memo from Monsanto, and they said, we cannot afford to lose a single dollar of business. And so what they did was just shift production to Newport in South Wales, where I was born and where I grew up the first sort of 5 years of my life before we went back to Petalba, which is where my family are from. But knowing that they did that, and knowing that the reasons are most likely because there was a history in all these places, there's a history of, in whether if it's in the South Wales area or the North Wales area, there's a history of heavy industry and, you know, chronic illness because of that industry, that any illness or contamination that comes from what they were doing could be masked by potentially. And there are also usually communities that that are impoverished, where there's a desperate need for employment and possibly not asking difficult questions of those potential employers, and a sense of a community that doesn't have as much of a voice. You know, they're not building these factories outside Oxford. they're not building them in the places we can all imagine. These are poor areas on the whole that have lost a lot of employment and are desperate, you know, for work, and have a history of chronic illness. And to know that it might be that these places were targeted for those very reasons just incenses me. And it's made me do, and this is not just true of this, but it's a lot of different things. It makes me feel like, well, whilst I have a platform and whilst I have any chance of having my voice heard and people to listen to me, if I can shine a light on what is happening in these places where people are being exploited and taken advantage of, and raise up people who are trying to do something about it, then I will do that every single time until that window is closed for me.
I'm going to move us now from Newport to Port Talbot, because when I was looking at your CV, which took me about 3 hours because you've done so much, it struck me as a place where something profound happened, not only for the community, but to you. So I was going to ask you, what made you want to do that 72-hour live telling of the Passion? What prompted you, and then what impact did it have on you, Michael Sheen?
Well, the relevance and the resonance of it continues even to this day, which will become clear as I tell you the story. But originally it was, so in Wales, we didn't have a national theatre in Wales for work in the English language until 2011, somewhere around that. And it was something that many, many people had tried to start up. It had never been successful. It had never taken. And there was a lot of arguing about it and a lot of politics around it. And anyway, it was an arduous, labyrinthine journey to get a national theatre in Wales to work in the English language. But it happened. And in its first season, I was asked if I would do something in that first season. And I rather pompously and arrogantly thought, oh, they're going to want me to do Hamlet in Cardiff. Oh, I don't want to do that. And so I went along to have the meeting. Anyway, turns out they didn't want me to do that. They talked about wanting to do things that were much closer to the community, maybe outside of traditional theatre spaces. To involve the community more. And I found myself thinking about, as I was growing up in Portalbert, there's a local park called Margam Park. And every couple of years, the local, and I think it was organized by the local Catholic community, there was a particular Catholic priest in the town who was sort of behind it, I think, originally. But they would do a passion play in the park, outdoors, and it was very community-based. You know, there'd be grandparents with their grandkids, you know, with trousers rolled up, wearing, you know, a sheet over them, coming out of the forest, I remember. And you'd sit on sort of bleacher seating, and you'd watch this passion play take place. And then there'd be the crucifixion up there on the steps. It was incredibly dramatic. I had a massive effect on me, just theatrically. It was very kind of powerful. And as you left at the end of the evening, as the sun was going down, the sun would set behind these crosses. And my drama teacher from comprehensive school used to play Jesus. I'd say, there's Ken Tucker on the cross. That's mental. And that sort of strange contradiction of the kind of the sacred and the profane. I'm not saying that Ken Tucker was profane by any means, but do you know what I mean? The domestic, the normal, the mundane, and then the extraordinary, the greatest story ever told, all those things coming together had a big effect on me. Anyway, as I was being, you know, asked about what sort of thing I might want to do, this kept coming into my head, this passion play. And I found myself saying the words, well, maybe I could do a sort of modern retelling of the passion story in the town. And as the words were coming out of my mouth, I was thinking, shut up, Michael. What are you talking about? That's ridiculous. Don't do that. This is never going to happen. But I sort of, and Lucy, who was the lady who I came to see, was one of the producers at National Theatre Wales. She just tortured me for about a year, pushing me to, you know, well, why don't you meet this? But I know you're not really going to do it, but why don't you meet this person to talk about? Why don't you meet Owen Shears, poet Owen Shears? Why don't you meet Wildworks, the Cornish Theatre Company who do stuff in communities? Why don't you meet this person? And anyway, eventually it just steamrolled into becoming this ridiculous idea that we would do one single performance that would last nonstop for 72 hours all around the town, working with the local community, as many people as possible in it. It would take place in all kinds of different places around the town. It would begin at dawn on Good Friday morning and would end on the Sunday night with the crucifixion on the big roundabout down by the beach. And of course, we had no idea who was going to come, how many people would come, what the weather would be like, all of these things. Anyway, I spent essentially about 2 years developing this whole project. And through the course of it, I didn't really know what it was going to be or how it was going to work. I sort of discovered it as it went along. And I discovered sort of what I wanted it to be about as I was doing it. And ultimately, I discovered that what I wanted it to be about was community. And rather than telling the story of a man who was this extraordinary man, who you know, went through these extraordinary events over these 3 days, ultimately it became a contemporary story about an extraordinary place and an extraordinary community. And the turning point for me was I was on holiday in Rome, and I went to the Vatican. I was in, you know, the Basilica, and there was this tiny, I was a bit overwhelmed by it. And I thought, I just need to have a sit down. And I looked across, and there was a little area I could see with a sort of light shining on it with a chair. And I thought, I'll go and sit in there. And it was a tiny little chapel, it turns out. It was called the Chapel of St. Joseph. And as I sat on this chair in this tiny little area, there were paintings all the way around me. And in each painting, it was a different aspect of Jesus's ministry. So in this picture, he was, you know, with children. In this picture, he was with people who were dying, and, you know, all different things. And I remember sitting there thinking, there are people in Pataldat, I mean, in every community, but, you know, in the community that I come from, there are people in Pataldat doing all of this right now. And they tend to be the people who are the most underfunded, they have the least support, no one knows about what they're doing, because it's the stuff that people don't really want to know about until they have need of it. And yet, without them, it would all fall apart. And here, you know, all of this extraordinary grandeur and this extraordinary stuff that's here, it's all about a man doing that. And yet the people who do that now have none of this. And I suddenly realized that's what it's about. That's what it's going to be about. So I spent time, those years, trying to meet every single group and organization and charity and support group and everything that was in this one town, this one community. I tried to meet as many of them as possible, find out what their work was, what they were doing, and try and include it in the piece somehow. And when we did the performance, it was extraordinary. It was a boiling hot weekend. It was like these, you know, weeks that we've had recently. It was ridiculous. And having said we didn't know how many people would come, at dawn on the beach on the Friday morning, there was about, I don't know, about 100 people maybe there. And then by the Sunday night, there are some estimates that there was somewhere near 15,000 people all congregated around that roundabout everywhere to watch the end of it. People just started coming from all over the world to this place, to Ptelbert. But the legacy of it is possibly the most important thing for me, because at the end of it, when we finished, people wanted it to keep going. People didn't want it to end. They felt something very special had happened, and that they had been part of something very special, and it had sort of created something special, and they didn't want it to go away. So people started talking about the passion effect in Ptelbert, and people started up new projects and new organizations and new jobs and all kinds of things. And Facebook groups sprang up and drama groups, all kinds of things, new community groups, connections have been made. But of course I left. The last performance was, you know, we finished the performance on the Sunday night. I think by the end of Monday, I was in the Cannes Film Festival. Talk about cultural, you know, ricochet. It was, I sort of had to go on and, you know, do whatever the next thing was. And but I couldn't let go of it. I absolutely couldn't let go of it. And all those organizations that I'd met and that the work I'd seen people doing had such a profound effect on me. And knowing that they were desperate, you know, to say, oh, can we just have a photo that we can put on the internet, or can we get something? And I realized more and more as time went on, and it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to do that. I wanted to get more involved. And so as the years went on, I realized that I either had to take a big step forward towards that kind of work or a step back, because I couldn't keep both things going. It was taking up so much of my time and my sort of emotional and psychological, you know, headspace. And so I realized I was going to take a step forward. And that's ultimately why I ended up moving back to Wales. And I started doing all the kinds of things that I've been doing over the last few years, and, you know, that led to doing this documentary, The Buried Stuff, and all the other things that I've been involved in. But also, ultimately, because a couple of years ago now, I was just starting to rehearse a play called Nye, about a night in Bevan, for the National Theatre. And yes, a night in Bevan, woohoo! And we started rehearsals in London at the National Theatre just really a month or so after the National Theatre of Wales had all its funding cut by the Arts Council of Wales, and there are lots of reasons for why that happened. It's not just like, oh, that's a terrible thing. I mean, there was justifications for it, but nevertheless, it meant essentially that we, after having only had our National Theatre of Wales for work in the English language for really, what, 14 years, it was gone. And having been part of that first season and like I say, having had such a profound effect on me, I felt like, well, we can't let this happen. We can't just let it go. And so, again, long story short, I ended up ultimately launching a new version of it, the Welsh National Theatre. I'm the artistic director of it. We did our first production at the very beginning of this year of Our Town.
It was fantastic.
Born Wilder's play, set in Wales. Rhiann came to see it in Llandudno. It toured. It opened in Swansea at the Grand Theatre, went to Llandudno, up to Mould, to Theatre Clwyd, and then to the Rose Theatre in Kingston. It's now, it was filmed, so it's available online to watch on the NT at Home site. We've had, you know, offers to go to the West End, to Broadway, internationally. Our next production will be a play called Owain and Henry, about Owain Glyndŵr. That will be at the Millennium Centre in Cardiff, and then a tour later. At the beginning of next year, we start Amadeus. That will be in Cardiff and then in the West End. So there are ongoing productions. I've commissioned new plays about Welsh stories for Welsh writers, Welsh theatre makers. We've got all kinds of projects about looking for talent, developing, nurturing talent, supporting it, finding it in the you know, places where there isn't as much support for people as there might be. Got new writing projects, all kinds of things to try and create a sort of ongoing future generation of theatre makers in Wales, and to try and create a sort of really thriving theatre scene at a time really when there were so many cuts, there were so many challenges for Welsh arts and culture. It seemed sort of perverse for me to be launching this thing and saying, we have no money, and yet we're going to be bigger than ever before. But, you know,
it's been a tremendous gift, that, to, you know, places like Llandudno, like, the whole place was absolutely full. And we tend to go and watch, you know, songs from the shows. We don't really go and see proper theatre. And it was a real gift. So I thank you for that. But now I want to go back to Nye, because I want to welcome on stage Martin Joseph, who is going to give us a performance of the song that he wrote in his honour. Martin, honestly, this is peak Welshness at Greenbelt for me. I got a Michael, I got a Martin, I got a Mike. Great. Over to you, Martin.
Nine days before I was born, you were gone. But what you left behind, great architect of health reform, came forth from your soft heart and tough mind. Nothing good comes easy, we fight for the dreams that we hold. You finally got that bill through, though you had to stuff their mouths with gold. If you know the chorus, please sing. And the purpose of power is to give it away. This is my truth, tell me yours. Freedom won't be freedom. Freedom won't be freedom until poverty is gone. So now your dream's alive and stronger. This tired and drained, it's 2 a.m. She summons up the strength again, she smiles. It's not for the way she does this job, it's a greater call that cannot be defined. The surgery, the plaster tape, the arm around, the aching and confused. And drugs to give that little one more time to play, they should never be refused. And the purpose of power is to give. This is my truth, this is my truth, tell me your freedom. Freedom won't be freedom until poverty is gone. So now your dream's alive and strong. The accident, the cancer cell, the final breath of sacrament at dawn. Beating heart, the broken and the cry of the fragile being born. Just 9 days before I was born, you were gone, but what you have left behind. Your greatest hour remains with us now. We're holding on with soft hearts and tough minds. For no society can call itself civilized if the sick are denied through a lack of means. If you don't believe me, go take a plane, my friend. Go break your arm and see what it would cost you if you lived in New Orleans. And the purpose of power is to... This, my truth, tell me, yeah! Freedom won't be freedom until poverty is gone. So now your dream's alive. One more time, I need your hands. And the purpose of power is to... Freedom won't be freedom until poverty is gone. So now your dream's alive, alive and strong. Nye Bevan, the 1947 Health Act, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Martin Joseph. You're a star. You really are. It's lovely to see you. Can you get down? Thank you very much. Diolch yn fawr iawn, Martin Joseph. Right, we've got about, oh, I think we've got 20 minutes left, and I've got to get quite a few more questions in. So, Michael Sheen,
yes.
Role models, you know, they're starting to emerge. You've got Nye Bevan, and I also saw you recently contribute, well, I think you did the documentary a while ago. And I want you to tell us a little bit about Richard Burton. Because you're both actors, come out of Wales and chosen very different paths. But Richard Burton still seemed to sing to you? He's an important figure.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I suppose something that has become very clear, I was part of setting up a project called A Writing Chance, which was about supporting writers who come from working class backgrounds who are experiencing obstacles to their getting, you know, further in their career. And one of the things that came out of that was discovering the importance of having people who have had a background similar to yours, who have gone on to do the thing that you want to do. That if you can see people out there who have done what you would like to do, it just makes it possible. It gives you conceptually the idea that it is possible. And obviously, if there isn't anyone that you see out there, it makes it seem even harder. There was a woman a Writing Chance program, who said that on her estate, the idea of her being a writer was like, in the estate that she came from, it would be like saying, I want to be an astronaut. I mean, there was just literally no, how do you start? It seemed as alien as the idea of being an astronaut. And ultimately, when she had her first book published, I was able to say to her, how does it feel to be an astronaut? Which was rather lovely. But so Richard Burton, you know, I come from the town I come from, Portalbert, that's what I consider home. It's where I grew up. It's where my family come from. It's, a working class steel town on the coast. It has it's had a lot of challenges over the year, obviously. Its fortunes have been so much tied to the steelworks, but the surrounding areas as well that had, you know, iron, coal, tin, all of that kind of stuff, a lot of deindustrialization, a lot of chronic illness, all of those things that we've talked about. It's not necessarily a place that you would think would produce a lot of poncy actors. And indeed, Richard Burton, you would not describe as a poncy actor, nor would you describe Anthony Hopkins as that. Rob Brydon, possibly. But Richard Burton and Anthony Hopkins, definitely not. But the fact that they both came from Portalbert meant that any kid like myself, it meant that just within the community, there was a sense of, well, yes, we do plays, we do school plays, there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, Richard Burton and Anthony Hopkins came from here. There was a kind of a support for that. There was a lot of amateur operatic societies. There's a lot of performance in the area and a kind of respect for it. The idea that, you know, that was a career path that you could do that had brought great glory to the area and to the community, feeling that Richard Burton had gone out there and, you know, had done everything that he had done and on the world stage. And that was a point of pride for the community. And therefore, anyone who wanted to do that, you didn't get sort of poo-pooed or looked down upon or seen as being something weird. It was a good thing. Now, that makes a massive difference to kids coming from that area. It made a big difference to me. But that combined with, and I was just very fortunate that as I was growing up, there was this extraordinary youth arts network in the area that was all funded through the education department, local, you know, authority. There were teachers giving up their time volunteering to doing these courses. I was, you know, part of the West Glamorgan Youth Theatre Company. And it was all set up by this one man, Godfrey Evans, who changed the lives of countless, hundreds, thousands of people from that area. Writers like Russell T. Davis, you know, actors like myself, all kinds of people came through the youth theatre. Catherine Zeta-Jones came through the youth dance company, youth orchestra, youth brass band, all these extraordinary things. So there was a lot of support for it. Now, as I got older and I moved away, I went to drama school, went on to, you know, work, I would look back and I would see all of this disappear. Schools no longer able to do school plays because there just wasn't the budget. There just wasn't the resource or the teachers able to give their time. The youth theatre's budget being cut, the funding gone. The grant that I got to go to drama school, gone, no longer in place. And seeing things that we thought that battles that had been fought and won that, you know, didn't think that we'd have to fight again. Things that happened in the late 50s with this sort of cultural revolution with plays like Look Back in Anger and Saturday Night, Sunday Morning and films and, you know, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. Suddenly, what were called regional voices and regional characters it was their stories being told. There was, it wasn't just Noel Coward plays anymore. It wasn't sort of middle class and upper class stuff. It was working class life, working class communities, stories from all over the country being told, and therefore people being accepted into that industry. Actors, you know, being able to speak in their own voices, their own accents, coming, telling their own stories. To see that start to be reversed again, where only people who are living in areas or go to schools that can afford to have theatre and to put on plays and that kind of stuff, you know, it was terrifying. And I think, you know, it heralded, I started to see that happening in the 90s. But I think it heralded something, a much wider thing where, again, battles that we thought were fought and won around things like fascism, around racism, around bigotry, around all kinds of, you know, things where we thought we were really moving forward. To see the rise of those things again, to see our NHS in crisis, something that was born out of the experience of World War II, you know, and rebuilding and a sense of working side by side, having a shared common goal. I don't think it's a coincidence that seeing, you know, the NHS under such crisis and the rise of kind of right-wing politics, in out-and-out fascism, sort of on the rise again. These are all things that are kind of, you know, just as we're starting to see people who can remember what it was like before the NHS came in. And there are very few of them left. When my dad came to see Nye, when I was doing Nye, he said, you know, I was just a little boy, really, when the NHS came in. I can't really remember what it was like before. And my dad was 84, 85 when he said that, and he has now passed away. He passed away last year. There are very few people who can remember anymore what it was like before. There are very few people who can remember what it was like during World War II and what it was like to be under the rise of fascism. As our cultural conscious memory of those things start to fade, so they start to rise again, and those battles have to be fought again. This is why partly I find it so moving to know that you have this festival, the things that you are fighting for, the values that you encapsulate and symbolize in this festival are the things that are worth fighting for. They are the things that we fought World War II for, why we set up the NHS, and these things must be supported. So good on you. Clap yourself.
Well, again, when I was looking at your CV, which I obviously spent a fair bit of time with, there are so many causes that you have supported, right? I looked at your CV and I thought, Michael Sheen is a seriously good man.
Well, I think I said this to you earlier, but I will say it again. There is a difference between a good man and trying to do good things. It is, and I find this more and more as life goes on, it is our very flaws. It is our weaknesses. It is our mistakes and our regrets and our pain and our grief and our loss that connects us. That's what, I mean, someone says God gets in, you know, between the cracks. It is not through a sense of, oh, I'm a good person and I do these good things. It is because I hurt and I regret and I fall down and I make the wrong choices and I've hurt people and I, you know, all of that stuff. It is because of that that I strive whenever I can to try and do whatever I can to help other people. It's not because of being some, you know, good person at all. Quite the opposite.
I was going to ask you if you're a man of faith, but do you know what? I don't really care because I think you're fantastic.
I think I have my faith ultimately in us, in people, and I think it's connected to what I was just saying. Really, I get to be, and this is one of the great privileges of my life. I get to be part of the Pride of Britain judging panel awards every year, and the thing that I'm struck by year after year after year is seeing people who've gone through unimaginable pain, grief, loss, who have gone through the things that I cannot imagine what it's like to go through, and to see that not break them, not turn them in on themselves, but to turn that into, and it will never make up for what they've gone through, but to turn that into trying to help other people who are going through something similar usually. I find that a miracle. Genuinely, I find that a miracle. Because, you know, I know when something just annoying happens to me, not terrible, it makes me kind of want to shut down. And, you know, to know that there are people who can turn darkness into light, I mean, genuinely affecting thousands and thousands of people, making their lives better when there could have been something that could have happened very differently. the outcome of those terrible experiences in other people could have been left alone with it. And but because of the darkness that these other people have gone through, they have tried to help those people, and it has had and it is having an enormous effect on people's lives for the better. I find that miraculous. It is a miracle, and that is to be celebrated, and that is to be fought for, and to be recognised, you know, and shouted out whenever you possibly can.
And given, you know, all the various the things that are ranged against us, and that and the good and life being good, you know, you talked about fascism and you talked about the NHS. Is that where you find your hopefulness? Because, you know, despite your fury and getting incensed at all this stuff that is ranged against us, there's a kind of a passionate hope that comes from you. Do you find your hope in those people?
I do. And as Martin sang, it's about soft hearts and tough minds. You know, there is nothing soft about trying to do good. I don't even like using that phrase, but to like turning darkness into light, helping people, supporting people when they need it, because we need it. It doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, how much money you've got, your background, nothing. Everyone needs help at some point. And that's when you turn and you look to see if the help is there. And if it is there, oh, what a privilege, what a wonderful thing. And that is community. You know, there is nothing soft about that, or, you know, nice, or it's tough. Goodness, community, support, love is tough. You know, it's hard. It's muscular and sinewy and challenging and difficult. But it's what makes it worth living. That's what life is. That is the meaning of life, isn't it?
I think that is the perfect place to pause and bring our session to a close. We are so grateful to hear from you. You are such an inspiring man.
Thank you.
And when we see you, for I feel we will see you in the bright field, we will welcome you so warmly, and you will be surrounded by lots of like-minded people. And you help us keep going, you know, we're grateful. Diolch o galon, Michael Sheen, and thank you very much to you all for being with us for the last hour. Thank you.
Yeah, see you in the bright field.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.